Friday, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Cutler Hour. My name is Michael Cutler, and appropriately enough, that's also the name of my program. Hope you've all had a terrific week. Looking forward to hopefully a good Memorial Day weekend. Those of you familiar with the program, who are familiar with me, know that I spent 30 years working for what used to be the Immigration and Naturalization Service, used to be under the Justice Department. In the wake of 9/11, the Bush administration, working with Congress, created DHS, an agency with the wonderful-sounding name Department of Homeland Security. Over the years, I've looked at the failures, and I believe in being honest and candid, and I'm always working on my candor, as you know. And so I have come to call DHS the Department of Homeland Surrender. The idea that our nation does not secure its borders, does not enforce the immigration laws, certainly leaves us vulnerable. It leaves us vulnerable to the potential for future terrorist attacks. It leaves us vulnerable to incursion and the establishment of drug cartel cells throughout the country. In fact, DHS admits that hundreds of American cities are now infested by members of not only the Mexican cartels, but MS-13 and various other transnational gangs, not just from Latin America, but literally from across the entire planet, whether it's Asian organized crime, the Russian mob, Jamaican posses, and so forth. So we really need to understand that first and foremost, a nation's security begins at its borders, borders that because of globalists and others who seek to make tons of money, our borders only exist on maps, and our immigration laws are not being enforced. In fact, the people most opposed to enforcing the immigration laws, incredibly, is the federal government, the government that is charged with protecting the nation. We'll get into that a little bit later on. But I do want you to know, if you're new to this program, that my objective, my goal, is to provide information, to provide the news and the perspectives that the mainstream media refuses to cover. And often we hear people say, well, it's the liberal bias. Well, I don't think it's so much the liberal bias, folks, as it is the corporate bias. Too many people are making too much money off of the current situation, and they will do well right up until the point, God forbid, when there is another attack. You know, the Chamber of Commerce, working with the hotel and hospitality industries, manufacturing associations, and the like, have created a program that they call the Discover America Partnership. Their goal is to make it ever easier, if I could get the words out, for foreign nationals to come to the United States. By law, by the way, foreign nationals are described accurately as aliens. Not an insult. The law simply says that any person who is not a citizen or national of our country is, in fact, an alien. It's a definition that works for every other country on the planet. But again, this country now is under the sway, under the influence, if you will, of the folks that stand to make the money. You know, it's illegal to drive under the influence, while our government is operating under the influence, not of booze or drugs, but of power and money offered by the political campaign contributions of so many folks who have so much to gain by keeping the status quo and making it ever easier for foreign workers to enter our country. Of course, the only people really suffering are the average Americans. So this is generally the focus of my program. I generally bring on guests who have a particular area of expertise. I do not believe in having the so-called talking heads come on who have opinions but can't justify them. I believe that it's important as Americans that we get the truth one way or the other. I hope to provide it here. Today, however, I will not have a guest join me. I will be flying solo. For the past couple of months, just about every program, if you've been following the show, has had guests. Today, I've decided this will be a good opportunity to just sit down and have a conversation with you, my audience. And it's always an honor and a privilege to do it. So I have this program here, the Michael Cutler Hour. Those of you, again, familiar with me know that I've started a new venture over at And Magazine, A-N-D, And Magazine, where I have my own website. The website is www.talkborder.com. That's one word, talk border, where I not only get to write commentaries, but I also do video interviews of interesting people, people that you probably are not very likely to see elsewhere or discuss issues that they won't be allowed to discuss elsewhere. So we have a bunch of videos up, and every week I do another interview, and we add that interview to this growing library to try to provide the information that incredibly is almost impossible to find anywhere else. Dennis Michael Lynch is the producer, the director of a documentary called They Come to America. I have a small role in that documentary. We interviewed him yesterday, or actually on Wednesday. And what was interesting was the statement he made about how difficult it is for him to get his film shown, that none of the film festivals would be willing to show his documentary, but they are, in some places, showing documentaries, as he put it, about men who shave their arms and legs. Wow. I mean, what more can I say? If you want to learn a little bit more about my own personal background, the fact that I was a 30-year officer with the INS, started as an inspector, became an agent 4 years later, going back to October 71 when I was sworn in. I'm a New Yorker. The ashes from 9/11 landed on my home. My neighbors were killed. It was one of those moments when, for me, as for so many of us, the world could never be the same. And that propelled me to take my show on the road, so to speak. But if you want to read more about me, I have my own personal website, michaelcutler.net. That's one word, michaelcutler.net. And certainly, I have an interesting introduction at talkborder.com. I'd love for you to go there. And there's another organization that I'm very proud to be a part of. They post my commentaries. I've had the privilege of being out there and working with them. They're on the opposite side of the country in Santa Barbara, California, where the weather is usually nothing short of spectacular. And that organization is known as CAPS, C-A-P-S. Their website is capsweb.org, Californians for Population Stabilization. California, you know, is one of the traditional border states, along with Arizona, New Mexico, and Texas. And I make the point, traditional border states, because let's face it, in my world, I believe that every one of our 50 states is a border state. Any state that has a seaport or an international airport, or any state that can be found along either the Mexican or Canadian border, is clearly a border state. There are over 5 million illegal aliens currently in the United States today who did not run our borders but entered the United States through ports of entry, such as airports, and then went on to violate the terms of their admission. So, again, that's part of the reason why I say that any state that has a seaport or an international airport is a border state. The other point that you need to remember is that I have been down to the U.S.-Mexican border, that more than 2,000-mile line in the sand, line that exists on geography maps, but is often nothing more than a speed bump for those determined to enter our country in violation of law. And what's remarkable is that when you get down to the border, you realize that nobody sets up a tent along the border. And what I mean is this. When illegal aliens, and it's not just folks from Mexico, but from just about every other country on the planet who do try to make their way into the country along that border, when they get here, they are not coming the way the astronauts who went to the moon went to the moon. You know, Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and the other astronauts who in the Apollo program went to the moon went there. They wanted to just stay for a couple of days, grab a couple of rocks, plant a flag, and head home. Illegal aliens who cross our border are not looking to grab a couple of rocks, plant a flag, and go home. They are heading to the rest of the country. There is a sizable illegal alien population to be found in every one of our 50 states, and many of those aliens got here and got to those states by running that Mexican border. So this idea that if you're not living in California, New Mexico, Arizona, or Texas, immigration is not a problem for you, you better think again. Back in 1988, I was assigned to the Unified Intelligence Division of the Drug Enforcement Administration Office in New York City. I was the first immigration agent who was assigned there. And I woke up one morning, I had a brain spasm, and I said, gee, wouldn't it be interesting to know who it is that we are arresting for narcotics trafficking activities right here in New York City? So I asked my supervisor up at DEA Intel if they could provide me with arrest statistics, or arrest reports, actually. Now, what's remarkable, back then, of course, everything was on paper. computers were there, but they were very crude and rudimentary compared to where we are today. So I waited about a week, maybe 10 days, nothing happened. And one day I came to work, and I couldn't find my desk. It was a case of be careful what you wish for. You just might get it. Well, I got it. Boy, did I get it. There were boxes all around my desk, boxes on my desk, under my desk, on my chair. I couldn't get to my chair. Couldn't get to my desk. Guess what was in the boxes? The arrest records that I asked for. So as I am moving the boxes out of the way and opening them up and shuffling through the paper and trying to find rhyme or reason to this avalanche of paper, a couple of the folks at DEA were bringing in still more hand trucks with still more boxes containing still more arrest records. I felt as though I was making a bizarre sort of movie. I wish I had a video of this. And it took me a couple of months to just sit there with a handheld calculator and crunch the numbers. And when I was done, I was astonished. Back in 1988, 1989, 1990, these numbers remained constant, basically. In New York City, roughly 60%, 60% of the people that we were arresting and prosecuting for drug trafficking and related crimes like money laundering and violence committed in support of drug activities, about 60% were identified as foreign-born. And what's interesting, and it's the case today as well, is that there's no place on an arrest report to indicate the immigration status of somebody that gets arrested. There's no place to indicate that in most paperwork, even if you apply for an SBA loan, a Small Business Administration loan. There are so many ways that our country is so eager and willing to ignore the immigration laws. Remarkable. But so now think about this. 25 years ago, roughly, a quarter of a century ago, New York City was getting hammered by the drug trade. I had friends like my good friend Everett Hatcher, a DEA agent, killed doing narcotics investigations. He was doing an undercover investigation when an Italian mobster by the name of Gus Faraci shot him in the head thinking that Hatch was an informant. What we later found out during the course of the investigation was this thug who killed my buddy, our colleague, was a bigot, thought that, well, Hatch is a black guy. He's probably an informant. I mean, who could imagine the federal agent who was black, an imbecile thug that killed him, shot him in the head, deprived his wife, her husband, his two young boys, their father. He deprived our country of a valiant federal agent who had also served honorably in the military. As I recall, Hatch had a master's degree. He was everything that any man would aspire to be. I was so proud to be able to say that he was one of my very closest friends in the law enforcement community. And in fact, the day he was killed, I remember coming to that desk up at DEA Intelligence, and I was startled to see him sitting in my chair with his feet up on my desk. And ironically, I said to Hatch, what are you doing here? And he had a great sense of humor and a tremendous laugh. He was a big teddy bear of a man. And he just roared and he said to me, of all things, Mike, how would you like to trade jobs? Neither of us could imagine that within just hours he would take two bullets to the head and be found dead by his colleagues. So we have this war on drugs and war on terror, but open borders, millions of people here, we don't know who they are. We have the food police warning us about the perils of too much salt, too much sugar in our diets. But when was the last time you saw a commercial warning about the dangers of cocaine or heroin or methamphetamine or crack? Not too many commercials, are there? As a parent, and I have my own children, I certainly wouldn't be thrilled if one of my kids really goes at it with the salt shaker. It doesn't please me. But, I mean, can you even begin to compare the kid that puts too much salt on his French fries with, God forbid, someone's son or daughter who snorts cocaine or shoots up heroin? But such is the nature of our country today. And I think part of our problem is this issue of campaign finance. As a federal agent, I was not allowed to accept so much as a cup of coffee. Not so much as a cup of coffee. And that's fine. The idea was to stay objective, to never allow anybody to think that you were beholden to them. We were instructed, in fact, that if you knocked on someone's door, not because they were the target of an investigation, but perhaps because maybe they were the neighbor of some guy or gal that we were investigating for committing felonies and that sort of thing, and we were trying to get their support, and, you know, we would ask them, are you familiar with this person, and so forth, and if they invited us in, which often happened, if they said, you know, Mr. Cutler, Agent Cutler, however they might have addressed me, we're having coffee and cake, why don't you sit down and join us? What was expected of me, and I will tell you what we all did, because I worked with a lot of my colleagues, we would say, thank you so much for your generosity. I'm happy with a glass of ice water. Because the idea was you didn't want to walk away from that situation and have that person think, well, this guy is now my personal friend. Because that then leads to complications in terms of dealing with them down the road. You wanted people to understand that we had to hold the public at arm's length and maintain our objectivity. Now, I want you to think about that. And I want you to consider what we hear in the political campaigns about how these characters go out there and boast about being the biggest fundraisers. And then you watch their supporters standing behind them, applauding wildly like a bunch of trained SEALs, because they say, I'm the best fundraiser. I've raised millions of dollars. You know, I was born on a Wednesday, but not last Wednesday. If a person writes a check for a candidate and says, here's $100, here's $25, here's $50, I don't think anybody expects they're going to get much in return for that check. But when the check starts to become thousands of dollars, when you have corporations underwriting campaigns, and when you look at Citizens United, where political contributions can be made, basically unlimited contributions, don't you think that what is expected is influence and access? I mean, goodness gracious, nobody is going to write a check that gets into those figures without an expectation of a return. So here we have a situation where our elections are looking more and more, if you're a car aficionado as I am, like the Mecum auto auction. You know, all that's missing is the auctioneer with the gavel. We are getting the best government money can buy, and most Americans sit out the elections, don't make the phone calls to their elected officials. So the politicians are there taking in the money, thinking that this is the only way they can get elected. And you know what? Largely, they're right. If you look at the power of the incumbent, it is rare, unless something really wild happens, that a bunch of political incumbents are swept out of office. It has happened on occasion. But, you know, it doesn't happen often enough. So you have politicians who have one goal and one goal in mind alone, winning the next election. For a politician, long-range planning means the next election day. And if it's a member of the House of Representatives, their cycle is every 2 years. They scarcely get reelected or elected for the first time when they immediately have to kick into campaign mode and start to think about that next election. But today, it's not just a matter of going out there and doing the bidding of their constituents, which is what I certainly believe the founding fathers had in mind. That's why they established the House of Representatives with a 2-year cycle versus the senators who had a 6-year cycle to keep the Congress close to the people. Today, the way campaign contributions go, it keeps the Congress close to the people with the deep pockets, close to the corporations or the interest groups with the deep pockets. It's astonishing. And there's a mythology that gets spewed. There's a young lady by the name of Izzy Lyman. She writes something called the Castillo Chronicles. I was just chatting with her this afternoon. Izzy, if you're listening, it was great to talk with you. She sent me an article, and it's about how in Amherst they are now opting out of the so-called Secure Communities program. Now, I want you to think about that. They're opting out of secure communities. And meanwhile, think of the word, secure communities. And here we are in Amherst, where they're saying that we are no longer going to deal with the secure communities program, even though the whole point to this program is to make the securities, the communities secure. Can you imagine anything wackier than that? That you have a program in place that's supposed to ensure the security of the people that live in that city. New York State has opted out of secure communities. Time and again, we see the same thing happening, time and again. And I have to tell you, it disturbs me. Because the politicians, the open borders crowd, I call them the immigration anarchists, are pushing desperately to ignore the immigration laws. Now, I'm not saying this simply because I enforce the immigration laws and nobody wants to minimize the work that they've done. But I want you to understand why we have immigration laws in the first place. And the best way you can do this is to go to my website, or you can go to capsweb.org, you can go to, you know, Talk Border, or you could simply go and punch into Google the following. Title 8, United States Code, Section 212. Title 8 deals with immigration law. Section 212 deals with the grounds by which an alien is supposed to be excluded from the United States. I want you to think about that. Because the grounds for excluding an alien gives clear evidence as to why we have immigration laws in the first place. And here's my premise, and I'm about to back it up. If I had to distill down the mission of immigration law enforcement, it can be distilled down to six simple words. Protect American lives, protect American jobs. Who on earth could argue against those two goals? And if you don't believe it, Title 8, United States Code, Section 212, is the grounds by which an alien should be excluded from the United States. And it starts out with aliens who suffer dangerous communicable diseases, okay, resistant tuberculosis and leprosy and so forth. There's a whole list. You know, the open borders folks get all excited and dewy-eyed and they get emotional and choked up. Oh, my God, they've closed Ellis Island. Well, I want you to remember that Ellis Island, folks, was a quarantine station. Quarantine station. Just like Alcatraz on the West Coast, we had Ellis Island on the East Coast. And they put Ellis Island on an island, or that facility on an island, so that nobody could get to the mainland unless the authorities wanted you to go to the mainland. They unceremoniously divided families up. Maybe the mother had a disease. She was told, you have to go home. The father got a clean bill of health. He was allowed to proceed onto the mainland with the children. Maybe one of the kids couldn't be admitted because of a disease or a problem. So that was how it was done. And the only choice that the family had was whether or not the family member who could not be admitted went home alone or with the other family members. Nobody said, oh my God, we've allowed the mother in, so now we have to allow the father in, the father with tuberculosis. They would say, well, this poor guy has a bad disease. We don't want that disease to spread through our population. You're going to have to go home. Now his wife had a choice. Go with her husband back to the home country or come to the United States by herself. And that's the way it worked. So first and foremost, hearkening back to the days of Ellis Island, the quarantine station, which was run by the Public Health Service, by the way, dangerous communicable diseases. Sort of related to a health issue, aliens who suffer dangerous, who have mental illness and are a danger to the community because they are either violent or sex offenders. And then we get to the aliens who have been previously deported, aliens with criminal histories, aliens who pose a threat because they're involved in crime, whether it's drug trafficking, whether it's gang activity, whether it's narcotics smuggling or human smuggling or money laundering or pimps and prostitutes, spies and terrorists, and human rights violators and war criminals. These are all categories of aliens who are supposed to be kept out of the United States. And then finally we get to the point, as you go down the list by order of importance, aliens who would become public charges and aliens who would take jobs that they're not lawfully entitled to take. Now, when you look at the economy and you look at how many Americans are out of work, you realize that the whole point of the exercise is to shield the American worker, to help to make certain that when there are jobs available, that Americans get the jobs. Nobody back then would dare look down their nose at an American worker and say, well, we don't need you. We can bring in foreign workers because they'll do the work. Not that you won't do, but for wages that you can't possibly accept. That's really the expression that you're not hearing. And that's why we have immigration laws. Arizona is now battling the federal government. I was very pleased and proud to work with a law firm retained by Governor Jan Brewer of Arizona over this Arizona immigration law, SB 1070. And I made a point in my declaration that for the first 4 years of my career with the INS starting in October 71, that you could say that at that time I had my eye to the peephole on America's front door. Because that's what this is about. That's why when you buy a house or you rent an apartment, generally the front door has a peephole and you get a doorbell or a door knocker or some other device, so that a stranger who seeks to enter into your house, into your home, has to announce their presence first, and then you as the homeowner or the apartment renter or whatever, you have the option of looking through that little peephole and saying, you know, I know that guy, he's a friend, I'll let him in. Or I see that that person seems to be okay, doesn't seem to pose a threat. On the other hand, if you look through the peephole, you don't like what you see, you don't have to let him in. And if the guy doesn't go away, you can call the cops and they'll come and dispose of the guy for you. That's what the immigration laws are supposed to be about. Very simple concept. But if you go back to what I said about the problem we had in New York back in the 80s, 60% of the people involved with drug trafficking in New York, foreign born. Nationally, by the way, that figure is about 30%, or it was back then. It's now estimated that about 27% of the inmate population in federal prisons are identified as illegal aliens. Certainly, 27% is not the percentage of our population where illegal aliens are concerned. There's a disproportionate representation. Now, this is not about vilifying aliens, legal or illegal. It's about stating fact. When an alien runs the border, it has to be believed that this person is doing it that way because they can't come in through the front door. They may have been a prior deport. They might be fugitives because they've committed heinous crimes in their own country. Perhaps they're coming to the United States to carry out criminal activity or terrorist activity. So what do? They sneak in. Now, there's another problem here, because by sneaking in, there is no record of their entry. By sneaking in, they're not fingerprinted. So when they sneak into the country by running the border, not only is there no record of their entry, but their fingerprints are not on file. So these folks may be able to falsely claim to be American citizens. One of the things I had to do as an immigration agent is to break false claims to citizenship. Because you would have people from Colombia or the Dominican Republic or Peru or whatever claim to be from Puerto Rico. Well, when I started working for the old INS, I was given Spanish language training, and we were trained that there were certain nuances in language, certain terminology that were used in Puerto Rico but not elsewhere, so that it would be a little bit easier perhaps to realize if someone was lying about being a U.S. citizen. That's very important. Because once we think someone's a citizen, we're not going to seek their removal when they come out of jail. An illegal alien or a deportable alien is supposed to be deported after they do jail time. So we have in place immigration laws, and we have governors and mayors saying, oh, we don't care if they're here illegally. If you're here illegally and you haven't been arrested and convicted of a felony, we don't want to do anything with you. We want you to stay here. We have a president of the United States who says, you know something? We don't want you to run the border, but if you do, we want to put you on a pathway to citizenship. That makes about as much sense as telling somebody, don't you dare break into my house, but upstairs I have Rolex watches, and in the fridge we have some prime steak and some great wine in the closet, but don't break into my house, but if you do, I'll give you the keys to the front door, and we'll fix up the guest room for you. Pardon me. That's what's going on today. Now, there's something else that I want to talk about. We are on the eve of Memorial Day weekend. We are supposed to remember our fallen soldiers who, since the founding of this nation, gave their lives and made the ultimate sacrifice. Think of how many soldiers not only made the ultimate sacrifice, but by going into combat have come home either mentally or physically diminished because of their horrific experiences. Now, here is a question that I've asked members of the military. One of the things that I do is speak as a public speaker for an organization known as Allen L. Freed Associates. They do seminars for the government, for the military, intelligence services, and so forth. And not long ago, I stood in front of a room in Washington, and in my audience primarily were colonels and generals from the United States Air Force and some of the folks from their intelligence division as well. And I said, you know, I don't want anybody reaching for a sidearm. I'm not wearing body armor today. I don't want to be a target. But can someone explain why we have a military? And these folks were very angry, and it was very obvious. Boy, they scowled at me. They were not happy. But then I continued and said to them, but here's my reason for saying this. If you had to distill down the primary mission for our military, the primary mission for any country's defensive military services. Would you not agree that that mission statement should say something about keeping our enemies as far from our shores as possible? I mean, isn't that, at the end of the day, distilling it down to the fewest and most direct words possible, the mission for the military? To keep our enemies as far from our shores as possible. So here's my question. How on earth can our military, courageous and valiant and talented and dedicated as they are, how can they accomplish their primary objective when our borders exist largely on maps alone, when to the determined smuggler or bad guy our border serves as no more than a speed bump, and when there are already unknown millions, perhaps tens of millions, of illegal aliens in our country whose identities, nationalities, backgrounds, affiliations, and intentions are unknown and impossible to know. After the event, I had a general come up to me. The guy looked a little bit like Jimmy Stewart in terms of his build. He was kind of tall and lanky. He didn't sound anything like Jimmy Stewart, who, by the way, was an amazing war hero. He not only played war heroes in the movies, he was a war hero. He was a pilot, flew bomber missions. But this general came up to me and he said, "Mr. Cutler, I want to thank you for reminding me how pissed I am at my own government." And what I said to this general was this. I said, "You know," and I said it to his colleagues as well, "yes, you're in the military and you have a chain of command to follow and you're limited in what you can and can't say in public and so forth. But being in the military does not mean you are not allowed to write letters to those elected representatives who allege to represent you and me and every other American in this country. See, it's not just about voting. We have a hell of a time getting people to vote, folks. I mean, we may not be happy with how things are turning out in the aftermath of the Arab Spring, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and so forth. But look at the people standing online for 2 days to vote, and then think of how many Americans would be rather sitting at home watching Dancing with the Stars or American Idol than learning about the politicians, learning about the issues, and then casting ballots. But our democratic process requires more than that. Our democratic process requires discourse. We as Americans have been cowed. We have been intimidated in the name of political correctness, I believe. Now, I'm all for being politically correct if the goal of political correctness is not to insult or denigrate another human being. I've spent too many years in law enforcement. I'm afraid my kids have heard me use some pretty nasty language over the years. But the bad words, so-called, that I have used may have dealt with body parts or bodily functions. I jokingly say that the F word isn't the worst word in the world. It's the one activity most people want to engage in, and it's the only reason we're all here. It's the N word or variations of that that are utterly unacceptable in my world. We don't ever want to use language that is hurtful to a fellow human being. But when we use political correctness as a way of distorting the truth, then we have a problem. You know, when you talk to people about the First Amendment, they can automatically, with great rapidity, rattle off freedom of speech, freedom of press, freedom of religion, and they're right. But they've left out two other components to the First Amendment. The right to seek redress of grievances, and boy, oh boy, folks, Terry Anderson, the late great radio talk show host, used to have a wonderful saying, "If you ain't mad, you ain't paying attention." Boy, was he ever right. Boy, do we have grievances. So that's also a part of the First Amendment. And the other part, the right to peaceably assemble. Well, think about why peaceably assembling is so important. Stop and give it thought. Because at the time that this great nation was founded, the only way that you could have that debate, that discourse, that argument, that conversation, was to walk into the same room with that person or stand under the same shade tree with that person and have that conversation or that argument. All that the Founding Fathers said was, do it peaceably. Don't start throwing punches. Do it in a civil manner. Today, of course, because of technology, we have many more venues. Yes, we could still have that meeting in someone's living room. We could have that meeting in the halls of Congress. We could have that meeting in a synagogue or a church or a mosque. We could have that meeting in a whole bunch of places. But we can also do it by telephone and certainly through the database, through the miracle of computers on websites and through the various media, whether it's Facebook or Twitter or whatever. So we have ample opportunities, but we need to continue the discourse, the dialogue, the arguments, the disagreements, because nobody, and I assure you, nobody has all the answers. Nobody gets it right all the time. And if you are so intimidated by somebody else's position that disagrees with your own, then maybe you need to reconsider your own position. I spoke at the Tea Party convention in Myrtle Beach several months ago. What a privilege that was. I got to speak right after Newt Gingrich. Of course, it wasn't the case, but I jokingly said afterwards that Newt was my warm-up act. But my point is this, though. There were some people who, in addressing the crowd, talked about how they must never even have contact with the other side. And I have to tell you, I couldn't disagree with that position more. I happen to be registered as a Democrat. And I've met people in the Tea Party, by the way, who are also former Democrats. But I've maintained my membership in the Democratic Party. I can't tell you the last time I voted for a Democrat for national office. I have real issues with them. But then I have real issues with all political parties. Because what's wrong with political parties is that it means that the politicians are beholden to a power structure within the political party, not beholden to their constituents. And that's the point to representative government, that you have a person in Washington, you have a person at City Hall or the state capitol who is supposed to be doing what's best for the people that they represent. Not for the political party. When you have a guy in a political party whose position is the whip, it sounds an awful lot like some mob boss like Tony Soprano, the whip. Keep him in line. And if you think I'm crazy, look at where we are today. Look at where we are today. When a Nancy Pelosi can have the chutzpah to stand up, and I'm not going to get into a discussion about Obamacare, but the chutzpah, as we say in Brooklyn, the nerve, the audacity, to say, you won't know what's in this legislation until after it's voted on. Would you buy a car that way? Imagine going into a car dealership, and there is a car in the far corner under a tarp with a velvet rope around it so you can't get too close, and you say to the salesman, I need a new car, and the guy says, yeah, I'll sell you the car under that tarp. And you say, well, what color is it? I don't know. Well, does it have two doors or four doors? It's got doors. Is it a stick or an automatic? One way or the other, it's got a transmission. How big is the engine? Big enough. Does it have a radio? Probably. Would you buy that car? And then you ask how much will it cost, and they say, well, we're not really sure, so just sign a blank check, give it to me, and next week we'll park it in your driveway, and then all your questions will be answered. The fact that the then Speaker of the House could have the chutzpah to stand in front of the cameras and say, you won't know what's in this bill till after it's voted on. Do we still live in a democratic republic? Do we live in a democratic republic where we are watching our expectations of privacy and freedom being whittled away on a day-to-day basis, all in the name of national security, where four-year-old little girls who go to hug their grandmas before they get on an airplane wind up getting thoroughly searched by one of the 60,000-plus employees of TSA, where an 85-year-old woman in a wheelchair gets thoroughly frisked, because somebody felt something in her adult diaper, and for the sake of justice, I sincerely hope it was brown and smelly, whatever they found in the damn thing. But this is what we are being told is national security. But meanwhile, we have no idea who is actually in our country. So now we come to a story that I wrote for my friends at CAPS. And I called it, appropriately enough, that the only thing worse than no security is false security. And it's the story about a citizen of Nigeria who was illegally present in the United States for 20 years. You got to love this guy's name. It starts out with Bimbo. And I was just on Chuck Wilder's program, and we kind of joked. And I said, well, this guy certainly did not look like what we would think of when you hear the word Bimbo. But his name was Bimbo forgive me, folks, this is a tough one, even for an old immigration agent. Olumayu Iwa Ayuwoli. And he was using the name of a guy by the name of Jerry Thomas, a hell of a lot easier to pronounce. Well, Jerry Thomas was killed 3 weeks after his identity had been stolen. Thomas had been, according to newspaper accounts, a petty thief. Now, this guy, Ayawole, bimbo, if you will, had an interesting job. He was working as a supervisor of a private security firm at Newark's Liberty International Airport. He supervised 30 other security officers. Maybe we should call them insecurity officers. So you have an illegal alien working in security. We know that there is an Al-Qaeda presence in Nigeria. I'm not accusing Bimbo of being a member of Al-Qaeda. But what I am saying is this. What kind of security do you have when the guy with the badge is an illegal alien? And we still aren't certain as to his real name. And the reason that I say this is that there was a newspaper account as to how the prosecutors went back into court and had bail raised from what I believe was $75,000 to $250,000 because they now believe he may have been using other names as well. As an immigration agent, one of the responsibilities that I had in working with prosecutors was to testify at bail hearings. I testified at bail hearings. And a bail hearing, for those of you not familiar with criminal justice and how it works, only consists of two issues. Issue number one, danger to the community. Is the guy a rapist? Is he accused of murder? Was he found with a weapon? Is he selling narcotics? Issue number two is risk of flight. You know, if we're dealing with some guy who's well-established, he's never been arrested before, he's living in his own home, he has many family members here, and the crime isn't all that serious, then bail is going to be relatively low because there's an expectation that he will show up. But if you have an illegal alien, and we're not even sure what his real name is, which means we don't even know if there's any ties in the community, the likelihood of this guy showing up for a hearing is between slim and none, and slim just left the building. So now we come full circle back to this idea about homeland security and about giving citizenship to illegal aliens who can't prove who they are. And by the way, the only way they found out about Bimbo wasn't because anybody did a real thorough investigation, although he had to undergo background checks as the head of security, especially a head of security of a company that operates at an airport. They did background checks, which, as you can see, and I've made this point even when I've testified before Congress, background checks are all but worthless. Because if the fingerprints aren't on file, those prints will come back as a no-hit. If he gives a false name, the false name comes back, no record, he's in like Flint. He will now get an official identity document in any name that he claims is his, and away we go. That was basically how the 19 terrorists who operated in our country before 9/11 operated. Prior to 9/11, the 9/11 Commission, and I provided testimony to the 9/11 Commission, was able to identify something on the order of 94 terrorists who operated in our country in the decade leading up to 9/11. Of those 94, 59, or about two-thirds of them, used immigration fraud, visa fraud, as a way of entering our country and hiding in plain sight, just the way that Bimbo did. There's more Bimbos out there, I assure you. And the only reason that they found out about him was somebody sent a letter. He got somebody angry. Maybe he wanted somebody to do something illegal. Who knows? I have no idea. But whatever it was, someone wrote a letter, and then people started to look at him. Had that letter not been sent, Mr. Bimbo would still be out there. So we're now told that the Secure Communities program will not be adhered to in Amherst. It's not being adhered to in New York, and people are paying a price. There's a story that I want to tell you about. There's a police officer. His name was Robert Machotti, a member of the Brooklyn South Task Force, member of the NYPD. That's one of the units within the PD. I worked closely with the NYPD. I worked particularly closely with the Brooklyn South Task Force many years ago, made lots of arrests with them, lots of drug dealers and bad guys who were operating in certain areas involved with violent crime. Officer Machotti, 24 years old, his wife was pregnant with his daughter, stops a guy who goes for his gun, bullets fly, Officer Machotti is killed. Years later, I met his daughter at a supermarket without meaning to. I noticed this very pretty young lady wearing a miniature police badge, what they call a courtesy shield. I asked her who the cop was. She said it was her father, but there wasn't that much emotion when she said that her father was dead. And I said, my gosh, how long has he been gone? And she said he died before she was born. And I asked if he had been killed in the line of duty, and she said that he had been, and suddenly I realized who this girl was. Now, I wound up testifying at the murder trial of the guy who was involved with the murder of Officer Machado. Rinaldo Rayside was the guy. He was a citizen, as I recall, of Panama. I had physically deported this guy. I put him on an airplane because a judge ruled that although he had a green card, that they were taking his green card from him because he had been convicted of committing drug crimes. So here is this thug who had his share of the American dream, and he blew it by becoming a criminal. I put him on an airplane. He came back in short time, gets arrested twice, by the NYPD. Now realize that because he was deported, because he was a criminal alien, he certainly committed a felony by reentering the United States. But under the sanctuary policies that were in place under our former mayor, Mayor Giuliani, everyone gets all excited about Giuliani, and we have the same nonsense under Bloomberg, the PD was under orders, do not notify immigration. So twice they had an opportunity for immigration to take custody of Rinaldo Rayside, and twice they blew it because of sanctuary policies that were in place. And the third time, of course, we know what happened. Officer Robert Machado gets killed. So we have these politicians proclaiming proudly, we're not going to take part in secure communities. When I spoke with Izzy earlier today, she was amazed. I don't think she realized that New York won't be involved, that all these other locales have no desire to do anything about immigration. You know, it's remarkable. I spoke earlier about going before the Tea Party convention in Myrtle Beach. I bumped into Newt Gingrich afterwards, after I had referred to him jokingly at the bar. We were having a couple drinks with some friends. I said, well, Newt was my warm-up act. Obviously, he wasn't, and everybody laughed. And then Newt came into the bar. And I approached him, and I identified myself, and I said, I'd love 30 seconds of your time. He said, okay, what do you want to talk about? And I said, you know, with all this talk about the need to create jobs, why don't you talk about the need to liberate jobs? It takes time and money to create a job. Somebody has to go out there and make a proposal and then try to get the money and convince people that the business they want to engage in is viable, that the economy would sustain it, that this would be a profitable enterprise. And you know the majority of new businesses fail. They do. So I said, but if you have an ongoing business that's very successful but employs illegal aliens, and we know and by the way, I don't buy this 11 million figure. I think we probably have 30 to 40 million illegal aliens in the United States. That's another one of the mythologies. But I said, if you went into these factories and into these offices and all these other places where people work and got rid of the illegal alien workforce on the very same day that the illegal workforce goes out the back door, you could be having the lawful workforce coming in through the front door. What do you think of that? What do you think of that? And I got to tell you, Mr. Gingrich looked at me with that look of the deer in the headlights of an oncoming 18-wheeler. Because that's the issue, folks. We're hearing about an unemployment rate of 8.3, 8.4. They get all excited. Last week they created 50,000 new jobs. We're dealing with millions of illegal aliens taking jobs that I assure you Americans would do if the jobs were freed up. But you're not hearing that. And what you're being told is that if politicians want the mythical Latino vote, then they have to be voting for pathways to citizenship for illegal aliens, pathways to citizenship for people who can't prove who they are. The greatest honor, the greatest privilege that a country can bestow upon a foreign national, an alien, if you will, is citizenship. Citizenship. So we are now telling people around the world that if you come to America, we want to make you a citizen, and we don't care how you get here. We don't care if you have total disregard and contempt for our laws. And then we hear about the DREAM Act. This is all about children. It's not about children, folks. It's another one of those big lies. Keep telling a lie often enough, people start to believe it. Winston tastes good like a cigarette should, convinced enough young people that smoking was wonderful, and they paid with their lives, they paid with their health, they got emphysema and lung cancer and heart disease. and mouth cancer because they were told Winston tastes good like a cigarette should. It's the same mythology, the same nonsense, the same blather. Oh, if you want the mythical Latino vote, if you are here as an American, and I don't care if you are of Latino ethnicity, I don't care if you're of Asian or Caucasian or whatever, it doesn't matter. If you are a citizen, you do not benefit by having aliens violate the immigration laws. We don't know who these folks are, so we don't know why they're here, whether it's simply to work or because they have something more sinister in mind. And if they are here to work, what it means is they are now going to be competing with Americans who are already out of work. They give you the unemployment number, but they don't talk about the underemployment number. They give you the unemployment number, but they don't count people who've been out of work for too long. They give you the unemployment number, but they're not giving you the number of Americans who are now living well below the poverty line in this country in this era. So think about the foreclosures of all those homes, and think of what happens to real estate prices when a house gets foreclosed. The house becomes abandoned. It becomes a problem for the neighborhood. If there's enough of those houses, people that might buy the houses of people that are of the homes that are owned by people still paying their mortgages look at abandoned buildings where maybe the hookers or the drug dealers have set up shop, and they think, wow, I don't want to move into that community. And even if that doesn't happen and the buildings just remain shuttered, by dumping so many houses on the market, supply and demand kicks in, then you drive down the price of the other houses. So you wind up with more houses where homeowners are so-called underwater. Because we've driven down the value of real estate in America by the glut of available housing. It's absolutely astonishing. And you have Alan Greenspan, just several years ago, going before the Fed when he directed the Fed, talking about how great it would be to bring in foreign workers who could buy up the houses that are being lost by Americans who are losing their homes because they can't work. This is a betrayal of the American people on a galactic scale, folks. This is why you need to be involved in your own government, because this is about your success. This is about your children's future. It's all well and good to see who's winning Dancing with the Stars. But no matter who wins Dancing with the Stars, you have a mortgage to pay. You have to put food on the table. You have to hope that you will be safe in your community. And the only way that we can accomplish these goals is to get the federal government and local governments to truly represent us. You know, I always write at the end of my commentaries that democracy is not a spectator sport. I write that when I submit my writings to the organizations that carry my work. Democracy is not a spectator sport. When we go to restaurants and we order food, we are generally very specific about the food that we want to eat and the way that we want it prepared. That's a fact of life. I don't know anybody, folks, who would walk into a restaurant and say to the waiter or waitress, throw some crap on the plate, I'll eat it. Most of us, if we're unhappy with the way the food was prepared, send it back, and if that doesn't work, we leave. But somehow, where these politicians are concerned, it's boring and it's not exciting, and they all lie. We've heard the stories. Oh, it's a bad guy or worse guy. Well, I want you to think about a conversation that you should have with your congressman or congresswoman or your senator or your governor or your mayor. You need to call them up or send them a letter. And not just say, I'm unhappy with what you're doing, but I'm so unhappy with what you're doing that if you don't stop the direction you're headed, I will work tirelessly. I will work ceaselessly. I will be as creative as possible to see to it that anybody, and I mean anybody, who runs against you will beat you in the next primary, beat you in the next election. Because I want you to think about something, and I just puzzled about this earlier today. They talk about the primaries and the elections and the mudslinging because out of desperation to win that job, I mean, that's what it is to these politicians. It's a job, isn't it? Think how they are willing to insult the family, the children of their opponents. They will pound them into the ground so they could get that job. And then they open the borders so that you're not competing against one or two people. You're competing against a human tsunami of workers who will come here and undercut you in terms of wages, in terms of working conditions, in terms of benefits. This is a game of musical chairs, and the politicians want the doors opened. They want lots more kids to come into that room, but they don't have a plan for bringing in any more chairs. And they think that this is somehow acceptable. And you know what? They think it's acceptable because most Americans haven't jumped on them and said, how dare you? How stupid do you think we are? This isn't about being conservative. It's not about being liberal. And to say that you don't like immigrants because you don't want illegal aliens to enter the United States, the reason that illegal aliens get the jobs is because they are horrifically exploited. They are treated like trash. Not long ago, I compared illegal aliens with rental cars. And if you think I've lost my mind, I assure you I have not. We abuse rental cars, don't we? How many times have you rented a car, and it could be the dead of winter, and you barely get the engine running, and we jump on the gas pedal and go ripping off at highway speed? Who cares what damage it does to the engine? Because this is a disposable vehicle. Have you ever taken a rental car into a gas station for an oil change? No, we run it into the ground, and when the wheels fall off, you call the number, a flatbed truck picks up the remains of what used to be a car, and they give you a new car. That is the way that illegal aliens are treated in the workplace. That's why employers love them. They can exploit them to death. And by the way, if we had a massive amnesty program, they couldn't be exploited then. So, as we saw in 86, as I saw firsthand as an agent, these folks will lose their jobs when they demand fair wages and decent working conditions and that they be paid on the books, and then we get the next wave of illegal aliens, and that's how we got where we are today. But meanwhile, because there are so many workers floating around the country, traditional economics kicks in, supply and demand, the supply has gone through the roof, the price goes down through the floorboards. That's why the De Beers Company, the diamond company, is very careful as to how many gemstone quality diamonds are put on the market at any given time, because they know if they flood the market with diamonds, you wouldn't have to pay much more for them than maybe for cut glass. So they tightly control the supply so that they can tightly control the cost, the profits. We are being betrayed. And the average American just sits back and says this is acceptable. If you think it's anti-immigrant to be opposed to having lots of illegal aliens enter the United States to be exploited, then you would believe that during that horrific era of American history when slavery was tolerated, you would believe that the person who wouldn't own a slave didn't like black people. That's how screwy these arguments are. We hear all about being compassionate about the foreign workers. When? I want to know when. Will our elected representatives be compassionate about American workers, about American kids who go to universities, who study their hearts out, who pour their blood, sweat, tears, and hard-earned dollars into an education, who run up student loans that look more like mortgage payments than student loan payments, and then when they go out into the job market, find out that the salaries they are getting are less than what they would pay a sanitation worker because they are able to import workers from India and other third world countries who will work for relative breadcrumbs, so that that investment in that education isn't much of an investment after all. This is the insanity of where we are today. We are told constantly that America was built by immigrants. But let me tell you, simply having lots of foreign nationals charge across an international border does not generally result in success. It results in catastrophe. What made America America, and most people don't know this, is that prior to the Second World War, the Labor Department was in charge of enforcing and administering the immigration laws. Because the understanding was that if you flooded the labor market with cheap foreign labor, Americans would never earn enough money to aspire to do better. The American dream was about getting that education, whether it was a formal education at a university or acquiring a trade, as my dad did, as a plumber, or some other high skill. Because education traditionally translated into more money. You had Alan Greenspan actually talk about how we've created a privileged elite out of Americans who have skills or education, and the solution to too much money being concentrated in that sector was to make Americans compete with foreign workers for their jobs, which, by the way, folks, is illegal and immoral and unreasonable and a betrayal. But he could actually make that statement on April the 30th, 2009, when he testified before the Senate Immigration Subcommittee, chaired by none other than Chuck Schumer, the man who used to be my congressman but was never my representative. And he gets away with it because the average American is asleep at the switch. Greenspan actually went on to say that we should work to eliminate or greatly reduce inequality in wages, not based on race, religion, or sex, I would agree with him, but based on skills, so that no matter how much education you have, you're not going to make any more money. I thought that was called communism. To each according to his needs, from each according to his ability. That is the death of the American dream, the engine that made America, America. This is true. If you go to my website, michaelcutler.net, go to capsweb.org, go check out my program at talkborder.com. This is the betrayal that we are facing at the hands of people who are elected to represent us. Imagine if they didn't think they were supposed to represent us, what they might be doing. So I have to ask you this question. As we focus, I hope, on the sacrifices of our men and women in the military for the past quarter millennium, roughly, what have you done to honor their sacrifices by being good Americans? What have you done to reach out to an elected representative and made him or her accountable? How many letters have you written? How many emails have you sent? How many phone calls have you made? How many meetings have you attended? Because if you have not engaged in those activities, you are not worthy of those sacrifices, folks. You might as well live in a dictatorship if you are not willing to take advantage of our constitutional freedoms, because they are going away. Look at the Fourth Amendment. Look at what has happened to our expectations of privacy and freedom. The Founding Fathers would have been appalled. I certainly don't ever want to get a window seat on a cruise missile. I always like to say that when I talk about airline security, and I do a lot of flying, a lot of traveling. But if we're going to give up some privacy, shouldn't we at least be getting some security? Richard Reed was the shoe bomber. Richard Reed, as a British subject, had the authority to get on board an airplane without first applying for and receiving a visa because of the visa waiver program. Richard Reed is the reason I wear loafers generally when I fly, because it's easier to take the shoes off and put them back on without having to wait online to sit down somewhere to put my shoes back on after I've gone through security. The fact that Reed could conceal bombs in his shoes is well known by the Department of Homeland Surrender. That's why we have to take our shoes off. But the fact that Reed could get on an airplane, or that Massawi, that citizen of France, a so-called 20th hijacker, could get on an airplane without first getting a visa, that's not going to change. In fact, if it does change, and it has, they've added more countries to the list of visa waiver countries. Never mind that visa requirement can provide a very important layer of security at a time when we're supposed to be all about security. What we are getting is theater. You cannot tell me that we have national security with no borders and unknown millions of foreign nationals living in our country from coast to coast and border to border. But, you know, my dad used to have a wonderful way of explaining things to me. He was one of those people who didn't have a formal education, but was one of the brightest guys I ever had the privilege of knowing. And my dad used to say to me, "Mike, you will teach people how they should treat you by letting them know early on what you're willing to accept." We have taught politicians that we will accept any nonsense that they dole out and do nothing about it. If you're a businessman, you had a small business, and you allowed your employees to get away with the nonsense that these employees of ours, because these elected representatives, folks, are our employees, well, if you ran a company that way, you would be bankrupt in short order. And by the way, isn't America bankrupt? Food for thought. It's been good joining you for this past hour. Once in a while, I like to do a solo act, so to speak, so I get the opportunity to share my thoughts with you. What I would ask you to do, if you have the time, is please go to capsweb.org, check out their articles. There are a bunch of hardworking folks in Santa Barbara, California, good people. I've had the privilege of working with them for a number of years. Please also go to my own personal website, michaelcutler.net. And finally, the website that I am so excited about, talkborder.com. Please visit it. Hope you like the videos. We're going to be posting more every single week. My mission is to provide you with the insight, the information that you're not going to get anywhere else. And that's why I'm here, and I hope that that's why you're here. Again, folks, I'd like to remind all of you to check out those wonderful websites, and I hope you have a terrific weekend, and please remember why we have a Memorial Day weekend in the first place. It's not about a white sale or a barbecue or an air show, and certainly I plan to take in the air show at Jones Beach and maybe see some of the ships that are here in New York Harbor. We've got the tall ships in and some of the warships are in, and it'll be great to thank some of the military servicemen who are on board those ships. But let's remember Memorial Day is to pay homage and respect to those who pay the ultimate price so that we could have this country if we're willing to fight to keep it. And the way we do that is by being the best citizens that we can, because after all, folks, as I always like to say, democracy is certainly not a spectator sport. Good night, everybody. See you next week. Have a wonderful weekend. Bye-bye.